Okay, let's go ahead and gather together. Okay, this session had several titles, and the one on your program's a little bit different than the one I got in my letter, but they're all basically the same, so it's not a problem. The one I got was Preparing to Meet the Needs of Today's Youth, and I'll modify that slightly, but we'll stay within the confines. I think the program had something about answering the questions of our youth, and that is also part of it. If you were at the two-week meeting in Pleasant Hill last year, this will be a little bit of a sequel, not a repetition, but a little bit of a sequel. Because I made the comment during that class, and some of the brethren here picked up on it, having to do with maybe we are teaching our young people pablum rather than meat. And the definition of pablum for you mothers is soft cereal that you feed your children. But in a philosophical and theological sense, it's worthless or at least oversimplified ideas. And I didn't mean that to be critical, but I guess I did mean that to be somewhat purposeful. If you were in the class that John just had, a lot of good information, but toward the end, he made a statement that just kind of sent a chill up my spine. If I remember right,
do I start over? No. John made a statement that just really caught my attention. He said he was probably going to college before he connected Christ and the deity. And why that struck me is John's an above average intelligence, above average Bible student, even at that time, and that disconnect was striking. I found it to be amazing. Not in a critical sense, but how many times our young people can say the books of the Bible and all of the plagues, and yet they don't get really what's going to keep them in the church. Not that those things aren't important. And that's what I meant by the concept of pablum when I made it last year. So with that, we're given this assignment, and this is basically an essence of what I was given from the brethren. 5 points to cover. Number one, the parent-child relationship as we prepare our young people for work of the Lord and hopefully continueth in the church. The concept of the redefinition of marriage, this has to do with homo and heterosexual. We'll spend most all of our time tomorrow on that. And tomorrow I'm not going to spend time with anything scintillating or trying to convince you that same-sex marriages are wrong. I'm going to assume we're all on that page. What I want to do tomorrow is talk about how do we instill that in our young people who are being bombarded and don't have their values as maybe set as you and I might have. Also, I've been asked to talk about absolute truth. Is there absolute truth? Well, you and I believe there is absolute truth, but most people don't. And our young people are being bombarded by that in our educational system and from their peers, and we got to be on the ball. Outdated morality. I think that's self-explanatory. Outdated morality. There's no need for it. Nobody's getting hurt. How do we deal with that with our young people? And the concept of philosophical evolution. And by that I mean talking about how evolution is false without using scientific principles. Because evolution is a philosophy more than a science. And we ought to be able to do it. Well, the basic question is, are we doing it? How are we doing? Well, with some of our young people, we may be doing quite well. They're still with us. But every congregation represented here has seen a loss of their young people. And I don't know what age to put on that, but I'm thinking in the 13 to 25 age bracket. So maybe it's not being done as well. I often hear phrases like, I can't believe they've left. Our congregation is decreasing. Well, Moses and the bulrushes is good, but it's simply not enough. We need to teach our young people Moses and the bulrushes. We need to teach them about the plagues. We need to teach them the historical elements, the books of the Bible. But that's not going to be enough to keep them. It's been my experience that congregations that are growing are probably teaching what their young people need. I'm often asked, what makes one congregation grow and another congregation not grow? Well, I don't have a magic answer, but I have a magic opinion. Congregations that grow keep their young people, and congregations that don't grow don't keep their young people. Now, if you keep your young people, then you've got an atmosphere that helps you attract outsiders also. And I think those two go very much hand in hand. But we need to remember, and again, I don't mean this to be critical, we cannot teach what we do not know. And some of the things, some of the topics that our young people need to be taught are not being taught by us because we don't know them, so you can't teach them. Now, I'm going to use some maybe long-lettered isms up here this morning, and I could go downstairs and ask them, okay, what do you want to know about postmodernism? What do you want to know about secularization? What do you want to know about modernism? And they would probably look at me like deer in the headlights because they won't necessarily use those terms. But if you explain to them what those terms are, they're the very things they're being bombarded with in our media, in our educational system, and we need to be on top of it. So that's my hope. Another way of looking at this as a title might be teaching our children to follow Christ before the world teaches them not to. Because I guarantee you, if we don't teach them to follow Christ, there's our culture and our world is very, very happy to teach our children. And they're very happy to do it free. They will not charge us, but it will be very, very costly. There are no guarantees as we deal with our young people, either those who are physically related to us or who are our spiritual children. But we certainly do need to influence them. We can't force them. You can't force anybody to accept the Lord. You can force someone maybe to get baptized. No, you can force somebody to get wet. But you can't force them to be converted. But that does not alleviate the people in this room, myself included very much in that, of having a real responsibility for it. We must influence them. I find the story of Daniel to be absolutely amazing from a plethora of avenues, but let me just comment on one of them. Young man, 13, 14, maybe 15 years old, taken from his support system, he goes to Babylon. We're not told one thing about his parents. But you don't get a young man like that who is set in his values for the Lord without having some really good stuff going on at home. I'm not going to say that's all of it. This morning I'm going to be talking a lot about the family. We'll move on to the congregational settings and other societal settings as we go through this. But the book of Daniel is absolutely amazing in that sense. He had to have parents. He had to have a support system that really taught him not only the memorization of the laws, but also the why to keep it and the why to do it. I think the flag of the truth primarily is in the family. That's where it has to be. That's where it is primarily won or lost. That is in no way to minimize the congregational's needs, and I think most congregations could vastly improve in their teaching of their young people, and we'll talk about that as the week goes on. One of the problems we have is that our young people need to be taught about certain schemes that Satan is using today that you and I didn't grow up with. So we don't know them. And I repeat, and I'm going to repeat this probably numerous times this week, we can't teach what we don't know. So we better get about knowing some of the things we need to teach. Now, I'm not saying that the things we teach them are wrong. If it's biblical, it's right, it's needed. It's just not answering all of their questions, and it's not answering the most, maybe some of the most important questions that they have. The church does play a very important role, but the church cannot do what the family undoes. When I teach a VBS, I just love having the children there, but I cringe because we have parents, usually not in the church, but in the neighborhood, who will send their kids to VBS for 5 days hoping that'll do it, and then they've got them for the other 51 weeks. There's no way in 5 days you're going to do what they're going to undo in the next 51 weeks. And that's certainly true of us in the church. I think we need more than indoctrination. We need more than formal, isolated teachings. Those are good things, but we need more than that. We need to address what's really being thrust at them. You know, the Scripture talks about it, and Paul talks about it in Ephesians 6, about the fiery darts of Satan. Those darts change. The truth doesn't change. The gospel doesn't change. The plan of salvation doesn't change, but Satan's darts do change. And the darts that were hurled at me when I was growing up are not the same darts that are being hurled at our young people today. Some of them are the same, but not all of them. And we lose them because we don't have answers to some of the things that they need to be hearing. They need to be immersed not simply in water, they need to be immersed spiritually. And what I mean by that is, yes, they need to be baptized for the remission of their sins, but they need to be converted in their inner being as to what's going on. And all of us want that. That is not the issue. I don't have to convince you that that's what you want to do. You know, I look at a row like this over here and I sprinkle around our little babies and little kids. And that's wonderful. But I ask myself, in 20 years, how many of them are still going to be with us? And I don't know the answer to that. I just know statistics. Less than half. Half would be probably a high number for most congregations and many families. Now, if you've been blessed and all your children are in the church, then you just get on your knees and thank God. That doesn't mean you had nothing to do with it, because I know you did. But having said that, we need to be thankful to God. A powerful truth is not contained in words until those words are coupled with deeds. And this is the concept of how our actions speak so much louder than our words. Somewhat of a catchy phrase, I guess, but I put it in there. Faith is often caught more than it's taught. And faith needs to be taught, but it has to be caught by an example, and that primary example, like it or not, is in the home. It can also be in the church, it can also be in our extended spiritual family, but it is in the home. What kind of questions are our young people asking? Well, I don't have all of them up here, but let me just give you a very quick smattering of some of the things that I think we need to maybe be more alert and better prepared to answer. Is there a God? If a young person asks you, is there a God? What are you going to say? Well, you'll say yes. Well, okay, I'm the young person. How do you know? Because the Bible tells me. Well, we wouldn't have a Bible if there wasn't a God, so if there's no God, we don't have a Bible. Can you talk to them about some of the real strong moral issues is why there's a God. Theological issues of why there's a God. Cosmology issues of why there's a God. I don't care whether we know those words, but can we sit down and answer our young people why there is a God? Other than, well, that's what our folks taught us. What's the nature of man? You ever taught a class on what's the nature of man? What's the basis for ethics and morality? Well, most of us are going to say, well, the Bible is the basis for ethics and morality. How do you know that? How do you know that? What about modernism, postmodernism, pluralism, secularization, and humanism? Anybody want to visit with our young people about those? Well, some of you could. And more of you could once we tell you what those phrases mean. And I'm not trying to use big words to confuse us. This is what they're getting. and whether they know these words, they tend to know these words once they get to college, but before college, they may not know those words, but they know the concepts. They know the concepts. Is there such a thing as truth? How do you convince a young person that there are absolute truths? You and I believe it because we believe the Bible. But how do you prove someone that there's absolute truths? What about evil and suffering? And I spent a whole day last year on this, the problem of pain. I think it was Friday of the first week. And one of the arguments that they get from the atheist or from the skeptic is, if your God is all-loving and your God is all-powerful, then why does he allow pain and suffering? Because an all-loving God would not want pain and suffering, and an all-powerful God would eliminate it. And since we have pain and suffering, your God must not exist. That's not a bad argument. It's wrong, but it's not a bad argument. What happens when we die? Those are the type of questions that guide our lives. And I think those are somewhat the questions that are going to determine at least a large percentage of our young people, what they're going to do. This was not from a Christian, but I thought it did apply to us. Ability is what you are capable of doing. Motivation determines what you will do, and attitude determines how well you will do it. Everybody here has the ability to do what I'm asking us to consider doing. The issues for us are the motivation and the attitude, because it will take work. It will take work. Nothing is sadder than a teacher who is no longer learning. Nothing is sadder than a teacher who is no longer learning. Because all that person can do is regurgitate what they've already regurgitated or heard and can never go any deeper. Or can never look at any of the fiery darts that are Satan's. I guess I would say that our goal is to help the thinkers believe and the believers think. Many people who do not believe in God, many of the young people who will leave the church, are some of our most capable thinkers. We need to help those brilliant minds to believe. And some of us that are believers maybe could use a little help in thinking a little bit more, and digging a little bit more, and searching a little bit more. We live in a very changing terrain. How many of you parents ever lost a child in Kmart or in the grocery store? Probably most all of you have. You remember that panic? Absolute panic. And then you find them in the M&Ms or somewhere. Usually you find them. Most times you look for them. Now they become teenagers and you wonder why you look for them. I don't know. But it is an awful feeling to lose a child. Now, place that with the feeling of losing them spiritually. Losing them spiritually. The anguish. And some of you know that feeling very well, and I'm not, again, trying to be critical. We're trying to be preventative. We live largely in an age in our society of what I would call parental outsourcing. We want other people and other institutions to raise our children for us. So we rely on the schools. We rely on daycare. We rely on this and that, and there is nothing wrong per se with any of those things other than they are not their parents. You and I are their parents, or their grandparents, or their extended family in the church. A lot of people simply want to have kids but don't want to take the time to raise them. I don't think I'm looking at those people. But we need to be very, very careful about what we do or don't do with our kids. There is no transference of responsibility for our young people. It's ours. It is ours. And we best be doing it. You can't transfer someone else's faith. You've got to transfer your faith to them. Our culture is raining down evil, secularism, humanism, immorality, materialism, redefinitions, modernism, postmodernism, and we could just go on and on. But that's not it. The issue is, will our young people drown? Will they drown? And you and I have all seen peers. When I was growing up in my home congregation in Indiana, there were primarily five or six of us I would call in that teenage group. Today, two, maybe three are still in the church. And that was a rather vibrant, Bible-believing group. What have we lost in the last decade? If I would ask you, what do you think we have lost most in the last decade? Well, there's just no end to that list. The word most kind of quantifies it. But let me share with you something that I think we have lost. We have lost definitions. We have lost definitions. Our young people, and I'll broaden that to our culture's young people, they no longer really know what the definition of marriage is. They no longer really know automatically what the definition of a godly family is. They don't really know the definition's difference between good and evil. Because if there are no absolute truths, then there are no absolute good and evils. What is it to be a human being? What is it to be created in the image of God? Certainly our culture and many of our young people have lost the sacredness of sexuality. And one of our days is going to be spent on morality and how we can try to help that. I mentioned marriage. Obviously tomorrow, a lot of what we're seeing in the news recently is a redefinition of marriage. I had a young person come up to me within the last 2 or 3 days, and what's it been, 2 weeks since the Supreme Court made it legal, maybe 3 weeks, I lose a little track of time. Let's say 2 weeks. He said, we've had 3 sermons on that since that came out. Well, that's not all bad. My thought was, well, maybe we should have had a few on it before it came out. And maybe they did. Maybe they did. But he was kind of laughing when he said that. He just thought that was kind of funny. The definition of a family. You and I can define them. Because we were raised in a different... Even the youngest of you in here that are able to track with what I'm saying, they were defined for us. You know what a marriage is. You know what a family should be. But our young people didn't grow up like you and I did. You want to feel old. Most of the people downstairs cannot remember 9/11. They've been told about it. But you've got to be 14 years old to have been alive. So I'm going to say you have to be 16 or 17 to have even had a chance to remember it. And in actuality, probably you need to be 18 or 19 to have ever remembered it. That is vividly burned into our brains. I know exactly where I was and what I was doing, and so do you. But as something as recent as that is, it doesn't register in their brain like it does yours and mine. And some of the things that are registering in their brains don't register in ours. I didn't think that was funny. Glenn will tell you when it's funny. In this class, I'll tell you when it's funny. Otherwise, it's not. Okay. No. But they're being taught through our educational system, through the media. I am not a prude. And I wish I were more of a prude, because I would probably be a better person. But even I wince now at some of the things I see on TV. And this is not an anti-TV thing. When I see two men or two women kissing on TV, it's channel surfing time. But that's what they're being raised with. And Satan's being very, very effective. How can that be if when in 1 John chapter 4, and Rick will probably deal with this to some extent, we are told that greater is he that is in you than he that is without? How can this be that Satan is having so much success? Well, it must be that the greater is not always in us. And it's our job to see that it gets into our young people. In Romans 13:11, Paul talks about awaken out of your sleep. Okay, that's what I need to do. I need to wake up. Maybe you need to wake up. When we teach our young people in church, our great tendency is to teach something we already know because that's the easiest route for us to take. But that may not be what they need the most to learn. So maybe we have to learn about some of Satan's fiery darts of today so that we can teach them in ways that maybe it wasn't necessary for you and I to be taught in because these concepts weren't around, or at least they weren't as open. Maybe we are going to have to kind of decide for some of us whether we want to have fun in the sun or fun in the sun. I think this may be on a later slide, but I'm going to interject it here because it's on my mind and it may not be on a later slide. I do not think we as a nation, and I do not think we as a church, have really figured out how to use retirement to the Lord's best cause. I do not think many times we have figured out how to use our blessed retirement, and I think retirement from the secular workforce is a wonderful thing, how to use that to do Titus chapter 2 more effectively, where it says the young older men and the older women teach the younger. Shakespeare in Hamlet said, if you live long enough, you'll be a child twice and an adult once. That's true, but I'm not sure that second childhood needs to start at 65. I have more envisioned it starting at 85 when dementia sets in. Well, maybe more on that. That's a little soapboxy. But I am looking at a tremendous wealth that could really benefit our young people if we would apply the great blessings that we have called retirement, maybe to execute Titus chapter 2 a little more fully. Are we teaching ourselves so we can teach them? I can't teach physics because I don't know physics. I can't teach calculus, even though I took 8-10 hours of it, because I didn't learn anything. I just passed. I can't teach it because I don't know it. Some of you can, but I can't teach what I don't know, and neither can you. When do our children become doubters and unbelievers? Well, I'm going to give you some statistics, and you can take statistics and do anything you want with them. You can make them sing and dance and say whatever you want. But I think the principle here is very interesting. And by doubters and unbelievers, I mean when they no longer believe that all of the accounts and the stories in the Bible are true. Now, this survey was of 1,000 young adults, 20 to 29 years of age, who were raised in the church, and I say church in the broad Protestant sense here. This wasn't just Church of Christ survey. But no longer go. These were people who were raised and went and no longer go. 39.8% of them had their first doubts in middle school. 44% had their first doubts in high school. That means 83 or 84% of them had their first doubts about the Bible before they got out of high school. 10% had their first doubts when they were in college. We tend to think that it's when they go off to college or the military or wherever that we may lose them. Well, that can happen. But mentally, the loss probably occurs way before then. Way before then. How many doubters are still attending church? I don't know. The second survey is when do children quit going to church? And again, this was that same group of Protestants that I referred to, and I'll cite the reference for this material. 95% of them attended church regularly during elementary and middle school. Now, remember when they first started having their doubts, so they were being taken, even though they weren't really buying at all. 55% attended regularly during high school years. 11% were still going during their early college years. And it was taken from, these statistics were taken from the book that I referenced there. Again, we can argue about the percentages, but I think the concept and the principles are pretty clear. I think the answer is meat and not fads. And here I want us to just seriously think. I believe we often underteach our young people, either because we underestimate their ability to grasp or we're not willing to put the work in to teach them the meat that they really need. Why do we have classes? Well, I hope it's to teach them what they're going to need to keep them faithful Christians. We need to ask ourselves, can we combat and refute the doctrines of Satan? If not, why not? If you can't combat this, at least in your own family and congregations, the results are going to continue. Must pablum be their diet? Well, I hope not. I hope not. But it may be that you and I have to teach ourselves in order to teach them about, yes, there is absolute truth. Yes, there is a God. Yes, there, science is not the answer. And on and on. I want to talk now just, well, I'll have to talk briefly because of the clock, but I want to talk about God's powerful restraints against evil. And I've listed four of them. The first one I put up there is conscience. I believe God has placed in each one of us and our children, our young people, a conscience. When you go to Romans chapter 2, verses 12 through 15, he talks about how the Gentiles were a law unto themselves. They had some sense of what was right and wrong. I think all of us do. Even if we don't know the Bible, even if someone doesn't own a Bible, they have a sense of it. That is a conscience, and that is an internal personal restraint that God uses against evil. I think the civil government is a restraint against evil. And I think that's largely why God has placed civil government and tells us to be under its laws, unless those laws obviously go against God. And we can go to Romans chapter 13, you can go to Peter, the books of Peter, and it talks about how we should honor and respect that. All of those are elements of restraining evil. The church, I believe, is to be an element that restrains evil. That's why we have examples and instructions in the church about church discipline. You cannot teach people how to behave if they don't understand there are negative consequences for negative behavior. And we as a culture, and sometimes we as a church, are no longer equating negative behavior with negative consequences. And we get very lax. Now, we need to be loving in our discipline. Charles talked yesterday, and maybe another speaker talked about, we should not be condemning because our intent is to save people. But I can give you a lot of verses that talk about not sparing the rod in our families. I know that spanking is not a popular thing today, but I also know that spanking is a biblical thing. But the one that we really want to talk about, because it's the one I've been assigned today, is the family. So we've got a personal restraint, a societal restraint, a spiritual restraint. When we get to the family, now we've got a relational restraint. What did I do?
just say keep talking and I'll try to fix it if I can.
Okay, well, I can do that. What that slide's all about is the family. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the family. While the conscience is a personal restraint, the family is a relational restraint. Because the family is the building block of a godly society and a godly church. That's why when God gave us the three great institutions, family, civil government, and church, He gave us the family first, because those other two rely upon the family. One of the problems we're having is we're trying to solve problems through society and through the church that can really only be solved through the family. And we need to take that very much to state. Have you ever noticed, and I think John asked this question in a different concept in the last hour, the difference between animals and humans when they're born? We're still agricultural enough. You see a little colt born. How long before he's running around? Hours? Or a calf? What about a human baby? It's just one big bloop. And it's one big bloop for about 9 months before they start walking, or 10 months. They're cute, but they're just... You ever wondered why God set the human family up so that we'd stay within our human family for 18 to 20 years? Whereas other species, they're gone in a matter of days, if not minutes. I believe it's because God understands that we need to be restrained from evil, and we need to be taught how to behave. We need to be taught how to behave. You know, we look... Well, the road got kind of distorted because Kelly got in the middle of it, but she's pretty too. But we look at these kids and we say, oh, they're so cute. Have you ever noticed that the longer their legs get, the shorter their angelic wings get? And what's cute right now isn't going to be cute in 10 years. You know, you'll be doing something. God knew that that's what we needed. We need to have this family, and I consider the church to be a family. We need that restraint. We need that to be working upon us in an effective way. The family, therefore, becomes the divinely given institution for the formation or for the restraint of sinful activity. I believe, and Dave's going to talk about leaders in the family or leading the family somehow tomorrow, so everything that I don't include, he will. So you can go to him. But one of the great functions of the family in a godly sense is to restrain our young people so that they will behave in a godly manner. And that takes work. We tell ourselves, well, I don't want to make them to go to church. Well, you make them go to school, you make them go to the doctor, you make them go to the dentist. How is that more important than going to church? Now, I understand, and I said earlier, you can't force them to believe. But you can sure kind of force them to be exposed to what they need to be believed in. But we need to then have an opportunity. Am I back? Okay, pardon me. I got to see where I'm at. I think I did this. I just love that one. Our children may start out as angels, but the longer their legs get, the shorter their wings become. But the parent-child is a tremendously powerful restraint upon our behavior. If you were raised in the church, you need to be very thankful of that. Many of you were not raised in the church, and I've said this over and over, and I'm going to say it again. I have utmost respect for you because you came into the church as an adult, and I don't know if I would have been submissive enough to have done it. But I got a lot of respect for those of you that have done it, because that is just a tremendous, tremendous accomplishment, and often produces the stronger Christian. Thank you, Joseph, or whoever. That's not what I want. Hang on, I can do this. Was that a laugh? Now you just wait a minute. Your apologies are accepted. I have no idea what I'm doing. In terms of the PowerPoint. Okay. If it disappears again, we're just going to forget it. Okay. Now where am I at? Righteous parents teach children about God to obey, and they thwart Satan's schemes. That's what we all want to do. And when I say parents, I include grandparents, and I include those of us in the church that aren't even related to physically, because this is our extended family. People don't buy 80 acres down the road from mom and dad and start their family anymore. So this is our extended family. We need to produce children that respond with honor in Exodus 20, as we're told, children, to honor your parents, and Paul repeats that in Ephesians chapter 6. There's a side to that. You may not recognize Deuteronomy 21, 20, and 21, but that's where it says a rebellious child, if he doesn't straighten up, you stone him. So there'd be a lot of empty seats here today, wouldn't there? I'm not going to take the time to go through these, but all of these passages in Proverbs are passages like spare the rod, spoil the child. In other words, parental discipline, as is church discipline, are important aspects. We have to teach that disobedience has consequences. Because that's the way the Lord's church operates. And if we don't learn it in our families, we probably won't learn it in the church. I'm not obviously a big advocate of John Calvin, but I found this quote that he had about Timothy. He said, Timothy was raised by his mother and his grandmother. He said, Timothy was reared in his infancy in such a way that he could suck in godliness along with his mother's milk. I just think that's wonderful imagery. It's been said by many people, you give me your children for 5 years and then they're mine forever. I'm not sure I totally believe that, or we wouldn't have adult converts like we see. But it is a tremendously sponge time, isn't it? Speaking again of Timothy's mother, as she helped him in her arms, she also sang the songs of Moses, whispered to him the prayer of Moses, the Psalms of David, and building in the principle of Joshua and the prophets. Just never underestimate the impact you can have. I will tell you, one of the greatest impacts that was on me as a young man, I was probably about 13 or 14, a man who's now dead by the name of Dale Harshey, and maybe one or two of you have heard that name. He taught our teenage class in Martinsville, Indiana, and at the end of whatever it was, 6 weeks, he brought in a stack of concordances, and he gave each one of us a hardback concordance about that. I've still got it. Is it a good concordance? Well, it's not the big one. But he showed enough interest in us to say, I want you to hang in there, and I want to do everything I can to help you hang in there. When we're with our young people, and I know we intend to do this, we need to treat them in such a way that they know how valuable they are to us. The young man, and he's probably downstairs right now, that led the songs this morning, about 4 years, 5 years ago, I had him in VBS at Ottawa. And his mom later came up and told me this. She said, well, how did class go? And he told her, well, how did John do? And I just held my breath. He said he was great, but that's not what the important thing. The reason he thought it was great is I remembered his name. I remembered his name, Quentin. You know how much that means to people. It means it to our young people. I'll go through this one rather quickly. But the family is under attack, but that's nothing new. There was polygamy. There was concubines. serial monogamy, divorce, adultery, sodomy, slavery. All of those were stresses on the family, and they're not new. They're just something that we need to be aware of. This is kind of in there for the fun. It's amazing how different speed readers we have here. But there is not a family here that hasn't been attacked by Satan. There's probably not a family here that hasn't been, in some not too distant extension, torn up because of divorce or adultery or immorality. We're in the same boat. Homes, marriages, parents, children. Remember, only spiritual solutions can solve spiritual problems. And we're talking about a spiritual problem. Physical things are not going to solve this. Only spiritual things are going to solve this. So are we prepared? It's a whole new battle. The truth doesn't change, but Satan's tactics do. Satan's tactics do. When I was growing up, you know, I don't know if I should say this. Yeah, I know. That's what you want me to say. Well, it was a comment on pornography. It existed when I grew up, but you had to go look for it. Or you had to go to the library and get National Geographic. You know what I'm talking about. Now it's just, they say the number one growing demographic for pornography are retired people. Because you can get it in the home and they've got time. I don't know if I believe that, I just find it interesting. Satan's arrows do change. How do you relate to teenagers? I was asked to comment on this, and we're going to have to pick a little bit of this up tomorrow. Well, you can do Mark Twain's approach. Mark Twain's the guy who said, when they reach 13, put them in a barrel with a knot hole, and when they reach 16, plug up the knot hole. That's one option. But seriously, we need to love them. That's a given. But we need to love them. But we need to also establish boundaries for them. We need to establish it because freedom is not freedom if there are no boundaries. And I'm going to reread tomorrow or the next day the reading that I did at Eminence on what freedom really is. Because when we get to morality, adults and young people don't understand what being free is. Freedom is not doing whatever you want. That's chaos. Freedom is having boundaries within which you operate. But our culture is more than willing to raise our children, our grandchildren, but that's not an allowable delegation. Let me ask you this as we near the end. If God called you home tomorrow or today, and that could happen, God calls you as a parent or a grandparent or a pillar in the church. He calls you home tomorrow. Could you look at your family and say, it's all good? If God called you home, called me home today, could I look at my family and say, it's all good? Well, if it's not, we've still got work to do. Because until they learn, Matthew 22:37, to love the Lord their God with all their heart, with all their mind, then our job's not done. And until we learn, Joshua 24:15, but as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord, our job's not done either. I should have just not done this one. But yesterday, Mike had a slide, and during one of my awake moments, I jotted down three things. And he was talking about those who are young in the church, young in the faith. And I thought, that applies to those that are young in chronology also. Do their specific questions and concerns get answered? I thought that was an excellent point Mike made yesterday. It's an excellent point. When you teach your young people in your congregation, are they getting their questions answered? Are they even asking you the questions? Are they connected with the body? And by that I mean, do they feel like they're a part of the congregation or just an extremity? My sense is this congregation's done a very good job of that over the years, because when I've been here, I've seen delegation to the young people. And that makes them feel a part. Not turning them loose with a complete free rein. I just think that's, people need to feel participatory. We all need that. And our young people need it. But do they understand why we do what we do? And that, and Mike said it in slightly different words, but I thought that was an excellent point. Not only for those young in the faith, but for those young in years. Okay, I'm going to stop there and pick up there. But I'm going to spend most of my time tomorrow will be on the how do we deal with our young people with the same-sex issues that we have bombarding us. Let me fast forward to another slide if I'm clever enough to do this. And if I'm not, we'll just not do it. It's lunchtime. Okay, I did not allow you any time for comments and questions, and I apologize for that. I will try to do that tomorrow, but please take advantage of the question and answer box if you have them, because this kind of topic has lots of thoughts, and your thoughts are as good, if not better, than some of my thoughts. Tomorrow we'll get into the same-sex issue and how to deal with that with our young people. And then the following day, we'll get into how to deal with the issue of are there absolute truths? Well, we believe there are, but how can we convince ourselves and our young people about that? I don't think there's any announcements. You got one? Oh, yeah, we got our prayer. Okay, if it's convenient, Bill, you want to come forward? Bill Norman will give us our closing prayer, and thanks for the food. Be back here at 1:10, if I recall. Is it 1:10? 1:10.